Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. A lot of ground to cover today with my guest, Jack Rasmus, on the economy. Always an important topic. Jack is a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College in Santa Clara University in California. He's also a freelance journalist, frequent speaker, a playwright, an author. His latest book is titled Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. And I don't know if I'll be the first to mention it, but Jack mentioned in an email to me ahead of the program that, my goodness, the ink is barely dry on his newest book, and he's got another one coming out. And imagine this for a title. Write it down. This is one you're probably going to want to get. And the title alone I absolutely concur with. It'll be out in 2011. I guess depending on what publishers want to do, they have a timetable of their own. But the title is Obama's Economy, Stagnation and Collapse, 2008-2010. A couple more comments from me, Jack, and then I'll let you jump in. Oh, I absolutely believe that, and I truly believe Obama will be a one-term president because of the terrible wreckage that he's done to the economy. And, Jack, you sent me an article. It was marvelous. I read it. You call it historical parallels in midterm elections. And you go back to Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton and Obama, and you throw in Ronald Reagan, and I forget if you mentioned Bush's father. I mean, he's in there, too. I mean, the Reagan-Bush coalition wrecked the economy. People forget we had a housing crisis in the 1980s. It was kind of a warm-up for the one that we got in the new millennium. But we have a colossal mess on our hands, and bad policy is only going to make it worse. We're going to talk about QE2, deficit reduction with Obama's deficit commission, and there's another deficit reduction commission that I'm writing about in a brand-new article. I mean, these people are absolute lunatics. Well, they may not be lunatics. They want for themselves, and they get it by taking from us. Jack, welcome.
My pleasure.
Oh, let's jump right in. I mean, there's an awful lot to get to, a full course meal and then some. You decide where you want to go first.
Well, I think the topics of the day. Last week, of course, QE2 was officially launched. They've been talking about it for a long time. QE2, for listeners, is simply one of these bureaucratic talk concepts, but really it means that the Federal Reserve is going to print money and pump it into the economy, and in so doing, according to the theory, which is a false theory, that will stimulate further production and recovery.
Jack, can I throw a question in, because mm-hmm. you made a point. You said the Fed printing money, creating credit, and pumping it into the economy. Well, QE1 didn't go into the economy so much. It went to bankers. Will QE2 be any different in your opinion?
Well, anything that the Fed does goes to bankers. You know, I mean, it's the banks or financial institutions that borrow from the Fed. You and I can go to the
Fed. Okay, I see where you're going. In other words,
get a zero interest loan that the bankers can. So, but you know, when you say bankers, you're just not talking about J.P. Morgan Chase. You're talking now about the entire financial system, the shadow banks of various kinds. Which, by the way, let me digress a bit. An interesting piece of news last week on shadow banks. Shadow banks means all those financial institutions that are not deposit institutions retail depositors, you and I, so forth, you know, like your corner or Wells Fargo Bank or some deposit institution. But shadow banks mean hedge funds, private equity firms, mutual funds, private banks, insurance companies, et cetera, et cetera. And the report that's just leaked out of the New York Fed, they've just done a study which estimates that the shadow banking sector is worth has about $20 trillion in assets here on the eve of the collapse, compared to the commercial regulated, then regulated banking sector, which had about $10 trillion. And apparently the new report by the Fed is that the shadow banking sector has shrunk, but it's still $16 trillion compared to $10 trillion. Now, it's interesting that those numbers that are just come out and just dribbling out now are exactly almost exactly the numbers I estimated a year and a half ago. I estimated what I called the global money parade of these shadow banking institutions that engage in all these speculative investments, you know, rather than allowing money to and capital to flow into job-producing investments, was somewhere between $10 and $20 trillion. And that's what's sloshing around the globe, causing all these financial bubbles and instability, which leads to these deep real economic contractions and unemployment and housing collapses and so forth. So it's interesting. They mention now 16 to 20 trillion, and that's the number that I had estimated over a year and a half ago. So you really don't need all those number crunches at the Fed to figure out which way the wind's blowing. But that's a digression.
Oh, wow, that's a big digression.
Yeah, it's
Jack.
It's a big digression. If someone's interested, they could read the article in the British Financial Times that came out yesterday by a very informed columnist, Gillian Tett, T-E-T-T, where she apparently was leaked a copy of this New York Fed report that's going to be coming out shortly. So this totally unregulated and still unregulated element of global finance, you know, is the dominant form of finance now. And as I said, the recent financial regulation bill and attempts to globally regulate this through in Europe with the Financial Stability Group, or, you know, the Bank of International Settlements, Basel II in Switzerland, you know, they have no control over this thing, and they're still running wild and provoking bubbles just as we speak. A whole set of commodity goods are we got bubbles in commodity goods going on. I think sugar and some of the other food commodities are at 20-year highs in terms of price. Cotton's at 140-year high. It's never been had a higher price since the Civil War.
I don't know.
And you can go on and on. We got these speculative bubbles going on,
Jack,
all over the world.
Sugar and you know, you follow the big ones: oil and gold and maybe a couple of others. But
well, gold is up there. Silver's rising. So is copper and tin and others: corn, wheat. Which is going to create this strange anomaly next year that I call deflation, for lack of better words, and that is we're going to see deflation amidst certain select speculative commodities which will rise quite rapidly and have a real negative effect. You know, food prices are going to rise significantly next year, and so will a number of other prices. Oil prices will not. That's a different market. When you have an economic collapse in manufacturing and so forth globally, then oil prices decline as they head off their highs. But we will see something of a commodity price boom bubble, just as we're seeing other bubbles going on right now beginning to emerge here and there around the world.
Jack,
a good bubble that people really need to watch out for, that I think is going to, and you've heard it here, prediction, is the municipal bond market in the United States. That may be the next subprime market that goes bust.
Maybe.
I'm not saying definitely, but it's in big trouble, and the states are in big trouble because the stimulus that had kept their heads, states and cities and school districts, heads just above water last year, The Obama stimulus is going to be gone in 2011, and we're going to see more school district and public employee layoffs and furloughs and benefit cuts. They're going to really go after the pension systems and cut those back. It's going to be a disaster for the public sector employees and services.
It really is going to be a disaster, and of course, California is.
California's at the lead of that. You know, they're trying to raise another $20 billion. That's the test case for this market. But you know, with no federal assistance forthcoming anymore, we're going to see the crisis really deepen in the state and local government and school district sector. Not that the Obama stimulus was all that good. You know, all it really did, and I've said this before, was designed to put a floor under the collapse for about a year. Collapse of consumption, collapse of the states and so forth, with the assumption, erroneous as it turned out, and I have been predicting for some time, that the markets would recover on their own in about a year, and the private sector would take off and start hiring, and the government's strategy of just putting a floor under the collapse, not really creating jobs, and not really solving the housing crisis. That was the big strategic error that Obama made. He just felt, okay, let's just get credit going again. Let's bail out the banks, give them $5 trillion, and in a year or so, they'll start lending, and business will start spending and investing. Well, neither has happened, as we know. Banks are sitting on $1 trillion worth of cash and not lending to small, medium businesses, but using it to speculate globally again.
Well, Jack, a question again. This was the point that I raised when I asked the other question. QE1 didn't work because the bankers got the money and speculated with it, bought up competition and so on. Do you feel, I don't know, but I kind of lean toward believing that they will do exactly the same thing with QE2?
Yes, in fact, though, it'll be worse. You know, the Fed gave $1.75 trillion in its first QE1. That's part of its $5 trillion injection. Mostly buying up bad mortgage bonds, rescuing the banks and the mortgage lenders and so forth, and also buying up long-term bonds and rescuing other financial sectors. Of course, we know that did not produce any real recovery. That's because they've left all the bad assets and bad debt still on these balance sheets, and all they did was offset them by injecting liquidity into these financial institutions, but the bad debts are still there. They're not gone. For whatever reasons, and there's a number of reasons, the banks are just sitting on the money and hoarding the money, over $1 trillion, because they got addicted, I believe, to these huge returns through the speculative markets, and that's where they've been loaning up to now. And, to make 10-20% returns speculating in foreign exchanges through their hedge fund buddies, they loan to the hedge funds big time, it's a lot more attractive to them than loaning to mom-and-pop business in the United States that would create jobs and waiting for 10-20 years for a return. That's the big change in capitalism and capitalist finance today, and everyone's addicted to it. They can't get off of it. They can't get off of those big returns.
You know, Jack, it's astonishing that anybody with a brain, well, Obama, of course, is the servant of the people who put him in office. He certainly isn't stupid. He certainly must have some knowledge, some idea. I'm not an economist, and I certainly do, that these banks are at the root of the problem, and simply reviving them, even if it's a temporary solution, by pumping this oxygen into them called cheap credit, all they're going to do is create more mischief. And instead of solving the problem we should be doing to get the economy back on the road, to create jobs, to create prosperity, I mean, that's what an administration is supposed to do. That's what the Fed really should be doing. Price stability and all that garbage. I mean, they should be creating prosperity, not destroying it. But
the question is how you do it, though. And that's the big issue. You see, this is a financial-induced collapse. It's not like the other 10 recessions, what I call normal recessions in my book, Epic Recession, in which you can engage in certain fiscal and monetary policy responses and stabilize the system. You can't stabilize the system with these typical responses. The system requires major structural changes at this point. And they haven't come to that conclusion yet, or they don't want to come to that conclusion because it means that the wealthy investors and so forth are going to have to take some haircuts, as they say. You know, they're going to have to pay part of the cost, and they don't want to do that. They really believe, I think, to some extent, that if they pump the money in, as they've done in other recessions, that it would stabilize after about a year, year and a half, and private sector would start lending and investing again. Well, as I pointed out, the banks aren't lending and businesses aren't investing. Businesses are sitting on, and the Fortune 500 are sitting on an even greater hoard of cash, $2 trillion of cash, and they're not investing it. Why aren't they investing? Well, one argument is, uncertainty about financial regulation and the health care law and so on and so forth. Well, nonsense. If there's any uncertainty factor here, it's because consumers aren't buying. And consumers aren't buying because they are really in a depressed state. You know, they've lost, we've had 10 million homes foreclosed in 3 years. 10 million. One out of almost 4.5 foreclosed. We've got over 25 million unemployed in this country. People have lost trillions of dollars in their 401k plans. Their homes, even if they haven't lost them, have collapsed in value. I can go on and on all the reasons why consumers aren't consuming. And they won't consume because they are up to their ears in debt and lack of growth of income. That's what I call in my book consumption fragility. You see, when it's a ratio of your debts to, and the debt servicing terms of your debts to your disposable income, and it's still extremely high, and it's an indicator mainstream economists don't really look at, but one I've been using to predict the course of this, and that's still a big problem. And they can't seem to turn it around. Only way you turn it around is to get rid of consumers' household debt, or increase their income. Well, their income is shrinking still. It has been for decades. But now they got this huge debt overload, and their income is shrinking. So their consumption is not going to return. And business is looking at that, and nothing's happening. You know, a big deal was made about retail sales last month, right? Oh, they've gone at 1.6%. Well, first of all, off of an extreme low of a year ago. But more importantly, those retail sales were driven largely by auto sales. And why did auto sales pick up? Because General Motors went into a big discounting competitive mode that the other auto companies had to follow. Why did GM go into that mode? Because GM was going to go public with an IPO and wanted to generate, and all IPO companies do this, pre-IPO do this, they do everything to make their income statement look really good, so they engage in these big discounts. So if you look at what's happening, retail sales are up because everyone's discounting in business, on the business side. And the discounting is reflected in the fact that deflation is creeping up on us. Slowly, slowly, we've been moving to a deflationary condition. In other words, the CPI, Consumer Price Index, has been dropping. It's probably negative now, although they say it's about 0.6%. And what's eerie about this is that if you look at the deflation that set in after the epic recession in Japan in the 90s, ours is tracking almost exactly to the deflation that occurred in Japan in the 1990s. And Japan ended up with a 20-year stagnation, and they're still stagnating.
It really is extraordinary, Jack. You've got to go back to the end of the 1980s, and Japan here 20 years later is still in the dump. But people forget that the so-called Nikkei average, the Japanese Dow, it peaked just slightly under 39,000. The last trading day of 1989, and I don't know exactly where it is now, but maybe it's about 9,000 or 10,000 now. So 20 years later, If you literally invested late in the 1980s in the Nikkei, you got slotted, and for the rest of your life, you'll never get your money back. You may get back a little bit. You know, Jack, I think when we look back at the end of the current decade on what's going on in this country, America, probably the reflection will be that this turned out to be a lost decade, and then all the postmortems about what we should have done but didn't do, and yet here we are, and we know really what should be done, and it's not being done, and bad policy is simply going to get bad results. When do you think this – we haven't seen the collapse yet, I guess because of all this oxygen being pumped in. And I must mention to you also that another regular guest on this program, a former Wall Street insider, Bob Chapman, he sees in the next 2 years $5 trillion of credit money printing from the Fed pumped into the economy, to the banks, and he says it'll flop the same way QE1 did. $5 trillion more dollars, Jack.
Well, I don't know if it'll get that high with QE2 because there is a lot of international and domestic opposition to QE2. I mean, the radical right in this country is, anti-Federal Reserve, and there's a little bit of good populist sentiment in that, but they're a little bit crazy too, and they don't really understand economics.
It's one thing about Ron Paul that yeah. I like. He wants to nationalize the Fed.
Yeah, well, then he might as well nationalize the banks because the Fed is part of the private banking system.
Indeed,
I mean, the private banks are really pull the strings with the Fed, and they always have. The Fed was designed in 1914 as a way of socializing collapses like this. In other words, prior to 1914, when the banks collapsed, and they did every decade or so, the bankers had to get together and pool the money and try to bail their bad sisters out. And it was getting too costly by 1907, so they figured, well, we got to get the Treasury to do this, which they did in 1907 with that big banking panic. But they figured we need an ongoing institution to bail us out every time this happens. And that's what the Fed was created for, really, to do that.
I guess J.P. Morgan got tired of being the central
banker.
Yeah,
right. the Fed has always played that role, which is a way of socializing the cost. In other words, it comes through the taxpayer or through Congress and Treasury, creates bonds that it gives to the Fed to sell, unless the Fed gets into quantitative easing, because the Fed also has this big weapon that's called printing money. And that's what it's doing right now and throwing it into the system. And it's interesting, Bernanke just came back from Europe where he there's been a lot of criticism of QE2 by the BRICS, Brazil, China, and others, because QE2, by throwing money out there, is driving down the value of the dollar. It's really a way of competitive devaluation by the U.S., and the hope is by driving down the cost of the dollar, U.S. exports will get more competitive, and they'll be able to take back the exports that the Germans and others have stolen from them, quote, stolen, in the last year because the euro was down because of the financial collapse in Europe. So what you're seeing now is a series of competitive devaluations by manipulating currencies. And what that reflects is that the big capitalist economies of the world, OECD economies, Japan, North America, Europe, and so forth, can't get their domestic economies going. So what they're doing now is fighting over a shrinking export manufacturing pie. In other words, they're trying to gain a national advantage at the expense of one of the other players. And that's a very significant development. And QE2 has to be seen in light of that. In other words, this is the U.S.'s move at one level of playing that game. And that's why the Chinese and the Brazilians and others, Germans, are all upset because they're going to steal. The U.S. is going to take away some of their exports. And they were hopping mad at the recent G20 meeting. But last week, Bernanke went to Europe, and he read them the Riot Act. He told them, go to hell. the U.S. is going to do this, whether you like it or not. Now he couches the argument in the, you know, we're going to stimulate our domestic economy. What that means is we're going to stimulate our exports, particularly manufacturing exports, at your expense. Well, but you know, everybody can play this game. This is exactly what went on in the 1930s. Then it was competitive devaluations by simply dictating a change in the value of each country's currency in relationship to gold. But everybody can play that game. And it sort of drove economies around the world already in depression into a deeper depressed state. And this is one of the aspects of epic recession. It's always global, and it ends up in currency volatilities, which exacerbate the problem. And that's what we're seeing now. This is a new phase of a problem in the system, where they're starting to fight amongst themselves, stealing each other's exports.
Well, back in the 1930s, we got Smoot-Hawley, among other things, Jack, as you know.
Yeah, it's very similar. It's parallel. But, you know, Smoot-Hawley was a tariffs game. We're going to get a price advantage in exports by tariffs and quotas. Well, here it's a currency manipulation game. But it's essentially the same thing going on. Of course, when you lower the dollar to get an export advantage to the U.S., what you're doing is raising the cost of imports. So American consumers are going to pay the price of QE2 with higher import prices. And that's another reason why we're going to see certain goods rising inflation next year, while other goods that are domestically produced are going to continue to decline, to deflate.
Oh, very definitely, Jack.
Yeah.
There's a point, and again, I'm not an economist, but I've raised it in some of the things that I've written, that we really have a very strange phenomenon going on. We have a deflationary economy, and at the same time, we have very obvious inflation in some areas.
I just explained it to you. Why?
Well,
you're absolutely right.
Well, you mentioned commodities. We also have it, I mean, every single year in healthcare. Healthcare gets more expensive far above the rate of inflation. Insurance, including insurance, including drug prices, including if you go to the hospital, what they'll charge you. Doctors are doing it too. Food prices, you mentioned. I mean, it's very, very strange.
History will show, when we look back at this decade, what a disaster the Obama health care bill is, simply because of one thing. It did not control health costs. No controls on health costs. It's really a health insurance company subsidization bill.
Well, there's no question about that.
I
wrote tons about that damn bill. I mean, just blasting it up one side and down the other. I mean, it was a gift to the drug companies. It was a gift to the big insurers.
Sure.
It was a gift to the big hospital chains. And it screwed people who need health care.
Well, even now, right now, I know for a fact, I've checked it out, the health insurance companies are raising their premiums 10 to 20%. 10 to 20% minimum right now, first year after the passage of the health care bill. I mean, it's a disaster.
It really is a disaster.
It's a cost disaster, you know, and there's a few goodies in it, you know, that the Democrats are really hyping, you know, the fact that your kids can stay on it till they're 26 and you can't deny previous... you can't drop people, that kind of thing. Those are all good things. But, you know, to pay almost $1 trillion for those few goodies and have uncontrolled costs follow in the wake of it, I mean, that's a disaster.
And getting rid of those non-coverages for past illnesses, the insurance are not stupid, Jack. They have a way of getting around this. Oh, yes, we'll cover you for the cancer we know you have, but we'll double your insurance costs.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's nothing. The bill is nothing without cost controls. You know, and the public option was supposed to provide some weak, minimal cost controls, but we didn't even get that, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Jack,
they should have walked away from that bill. That bill is worse.
We have a lot more we want to cover before the program's over. We're nearly at the break.
One more thing on QE, then, before we go to the break. QE, as I said, is designed for international competitive reasons. It's designed also to raise inflationary expectations to try to offset this deflation trend going on. You see, Bernanke is is paranoid about, and rightfully so, about deflation, because when if prices continue to fall, what do people do, consumers? Well, they wait. The prices fall further. They don't spend.
Oh, indeed. We have to break. When we come back,
okay,
let's talk about fiscal austerity. That's a big topic. We'll take a short break and be right back.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary. The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, carolee@garynoll.com. That's K-A-R-A-L-E-E @garynoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world, every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back on with Jack Rasmus, talking about the mess in the economy. Jack, I've got a brand new article I'll put out on Monday. I call it Destructive Neoliberal Austerity, and I go into what is happening across Europe. The same austerity deal, sock it to working households, and be sure you take care of the bankers and the rich folks in the country. And, this is just proliferating, not just in Eastern Europe, where it really exploded. Countries like Latvia and Hungary and Iceland, they've been decimated. But, it's hammering other countries. The latest one in the headlines is Ireland. And, Ireland is an absolute mess. But I think there's a mess in a lot of those countries.
Oh, Portugal, Spain, Italy.
Oh, absolutely.
They're all
so
very close
pigs.
Behind.
The other deficit-cutting commission that I wanted to mention, Jack, listeners may be familiar with Obama's commission, and they came out with their proposal from hell. I wrote about it in one article, and I go into the other one in this article. The group is called the Bipartisan Policy Center, and its co-chair's got 19 people on it. You know, they're people that you'd imagine, you know, elitists from government, business, so on, past people in government. And it's co-chaired by Alice Rivlin. She was a budget director for Clinton. She was also a Congressional Budget Office director. And former Senator Pete Domenici, Republican senator, retired. And they come out with a plan, Jack, that is at least as bad, maybe even worse than the one that that Obama's team came out with. I mean, it is really a wretched plan. And I think the centerpiece is cutting, probably slashing over time, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Well, I absolutely agree with you.
Fiscal austerity, Jack.
Yeah. Well, you know, when Obama was first elected, I wrote an article in Z Magazine based upon what I observed in his program and his movement to the right over the course of the election and his program. And interestingly, I had predicted at the close of that article that Obama would result in a major austerity program. This was over 2 years ago. In that particular article, and everyone was, you know, euphoric about Obama and thinking that was going to be a very progressive outcome. But I read the tea leaves, I guess, correct at that particular time what it would mean. Yes, we've got two plans. They aren't really that much different, you know, the Deficit Commission and the Rivlin Commission, but they're designed to make it look like, there's options here. But what you're going to see is a debate over the middle ground between those two plans, both of which, as you point out, are very negative as far as the middle class is concerned in this country. So it looks like there's going to be a debate, but it's people debating with themselves, people with similar views debating with themselves. And you're absolutely right. The real attack is going to be on Social Security, which, by the way, has been producing a multi-trillion dollar surplus in this country for the last 25 years, a surplus that the government's been borrowing every year and using it to spend. We've created $2.5 trillion surplus in Social Security Trust Fund, but every year they borrow the money, put an IOU in it, special bonds that can't be spent, and go off and spend the real money.
Oh, they spend the real money, Jack. You're being
kind. They spend the real money. On what? On tax cuts for wealthy investors, trillions of dollars, and on wars.
Jack, let me point out one thing people may forget. I mean, everybody who's working has a payroll tax deduction, and people forget that Medicare and Social Security are not welfare. They're not welfare when you get them. They're insurance plans that we all pay into, and as far as I'm concerned, I began paying into them, well, Social Security as long as I've been working during my working lifetime. But when Medicare was established in the mid-1960s, I paid into that. And my understanding was, and I think you could make a legal case for it, was the government and I and every other wage earner signed a contract. And the contract is that we will pay premiums during our working lifetime, and we will get these benefits when we retire. There was nothing in the contract that said we'll reduce them, we'll tax them, we'll do whatever we want, we'll change the contract. That wasn't the deal. The deal was I pay my premiums, and I get benefits so many years later. But, of course, they're corrupting the whole deal, and they're doing what they want.
Yeah, well, actually, it's more like an annuity in the sense that if you had an annuity with some insurance company and they tried to unilaterally change the terms halfway through the whole process of paying you back, then obviously you'd have a legal case against them. So your analogy is correct, but I would just say it's an annuity, not an insurance plan.
Well, I would say this, Jack, also, that we could have a slam dunk case, but you get into a right-wing federal court, and you don't have a prayer.
Oh, no. This is all politics determined here.
Oh, it's all politics, is right.
Look, ever since the Ronald Reagan, they attempted to gut Social Security. They had to back off, and what did they do? They raised the payroll tax to create this super surplus that they then, pulled out every year.
Alan Greenspan,
under Bush, they tried to privatize it. Under Bush.
Yeah.
And what you're seeing here is, in order to privatize Social Security and Medicare, they got to first, you see. They got to undermine it to the point where it's there's such a crisis in it that people will feel, well, gee, maybe we really need to reorganize it. And, gee, maybe it's better if I just get some of my money out. It's like what they did to pension plans, defined benefit pension plans.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Before you could convert them to 401ks, you had to sort of run them into the ground and convince workers that, well, gee, maybe I can get at least half of my money out if they, you know, disassemble it, and then I'll at least put half in the 401k plan. You got to terrorize people first, and that's what they're doing here. This is a prelude to come back and gut Social Security, a repeat that they couldn't do under Bush and under Reagan. Now they're taking another swipe at it. You know, we should not be talking about raising the retirement age and reducing benefits. What we should be talking about is reducing the retirement age and giving people extra incentives to reduce the retirement age so we can give those jobs to young people.
Oh,
who
amen.
Need them.
Amen.
That's what we need to do.
That's exactly
just the opposite.
Right.
You know, and one of my proposals is, you know, this rule that after you retire at 66, you can work full time. I would rather give people special incentives and additional payment in Social Security for not working after 66. And I would like to give people additional incentives and a greater percentage of full Social Security payments to retire before 66. And we could free up millions of jobs for younger folks in doing so. You know, the biggest, perhaps now the only growth in the labor force is people over 60, because Social Security is not enough the way it is formulated to sustain yourself in living, you know, reasonable living standards. So they got to work. Everybody else is leaving the labor force. For a variety of reasons, they can't find work. But the older folks are coming back and taking part-time jobs because they have to. Well, we could create more jobs.
We should create more jobs. Jack, part of the in the Rivlin-Domenici plan, they say that raising the retirement age will make people work longer to compensate for the lower benefits they'll get when they do retire. I mean, what a hideous! They actually said that in their report.
Mm-hmm.
I went into detail. I go into detail. I haven't put it out yet. I go into detail on what their plan is. I mean, it literally is a plan from hell. It sounds worse than the Obama deficit team. They have a VAT in there that easily can be raised at any time, 6.5% of value added tax, a national sales tax. It's one proposal after another that makes you wonder what on earth is on these people's minds to come out with a plan like this. That with all the trouble people are facing today, if this thing ever got passed or most of it, it would create a much greater crushing burden on them.
Well, but you got to understand that the whole idea is we're going to make the middle class and working people pay for the deficit. The deficits that we've created that are the result of tax cuts for the rich, $3.7 trillion just over the last 10 years. It's all about the Bush tax cuts, you see. You know, the wars that we're running that are costing us trillions of dollars with no national security advantage to the United States at all in the Middle East, you know, Afghanistan. I mean, what is Afghanistan? It's just, you know, probably the most backward country in the world. What are we really there for? There's, you know, probably the oil pipelines that running north and south.
Oh, very definitely.
But, yeah. But, you know, there's nothing there in terms of U.S. security that we need to be concerned about. So someone's got to pay for this, and when you bail out the banks and financial sector, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s and now in the 2000s, you're running bigger and bigger deficits. And the question is, who's going to pay for them? That's the debate going on in Europe right now. You know, Germany is saying that the bondholders who hold the debts should take a haircut. They should pay some of the cost. And the bondholders and banks are saying, no, make the people pay the cost. And that's what the big debate is over there right now. And that's the issue. That's the fundamental issue. Who's going to pay for these deficits? Who caused the deficits, first of all? It's not Social Security. It's been running a surplus, okay? So the deficits are a result of war and tax cuts. Tax system turned upside down in the last 30 years. So who's going to pay for the debts? That's the next question. Is it going to be the bondholders, the investors, or is it going to be the rest of the taxpayers? Well, they're saying the taxpayers. And that's what we're looking at here in these two deficit commissions.
Well, absolutely. There may be a debate in Europe, Jack, in Germany or whatever, but there's no debate in the U.S.
Right.
The Democrats and Republicans are on the same page. They form both these commissions are bipartisan.
It's a shell game. You're absolutely right, yes.
Oh, it's a shell game, absolutely. Smoke and mirrors and get people to think. You put up some people that have the appearance, it's a fake appearance, but an appearance of credibility. And, of course, their job is literally to make people be convinced that, indeed, we do have a crisis. Another phrase they use, Jack, I mean, they pull this stuff right out of Orwell. They talk about shared sacrifice, quote unquote, shared sacrifice. Well,
no, I got a better phrase for you, and this is the phrase that they've been using for 30 years and going after Social Security and social programs, social safety net. They say we got to first starve the beast, as they say.
And
that was
starve
make it
too.
Go broke, and only when we create the impression of a crisis can we then get what we want.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I say their idea of shared sacrifice is they do the sharing and we do the sacrificing.
That's pretty accurate. Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's get into some of what you wrote in your article, historical parallels in midterm elections.
Mm-hmm.
And I like your idea that you go back and you look at past administrations, and they did it wrong, and they lost big time in midterm elections. A new administration came to power, and it looks like Obama so far is following that same pattern. Explain that, going back to Richard Nixon.
Right. Okay. So let's look at the last three decades, because after a while, patterns begin to appear. Jimmy Carter comes into office in 1976. The Republicans had really messed up the economy. We had this super inflation. We had the worst recession, 73-75. We had Watergate scandals. We had the collapse in Vietnam and so forth. He comes into office with the majorities in both houses of Congress, a tremendous opportunity to really make some changes. And what does he do? He just totally blows it in the first 2 years. He doesn't come up with any solutions, any real program for change. He dilly-dallies around. And after the first 2 years, businesses and corporate America and Republicans rally, and they trounce him in the midterm elections in 78, and he turns into a Republican. He moves right. He tries to out-Republican the Republicans in order to stay in office, of course. And what did we get out of it? We got Ronald Reagan, and we all know that story. So now we have Bill Clinton comes into office in 1992. The Republicans had messed up the economy. We had the junk bond collapse, the SNL collapse. We had the recession in 1990-91. We couldn't get a recovery. Jobs weren't recovering. Clinton comes into office 2 years, completely blows it, and midterm elections, 94, rightward swing, and for the rest of his term, what's he do? He acts like a Republican. So the Democrats come in for 2 years, they mess it up, they can't even deliver their own minimal program, and then they turn Republicans. And what do we get about Obama? Same thing. We get a collapse of the economy, right? We get ongoing wars that are just draining our treasuries, and big tax cuts for the rich, and the economy collapses, financial collapse. 2 years, Obama blows it, and now we're seeing the same thing, the third time, the Democrats move right, and he will act like a Republican. I call him Jimmy Carter Obama today because that's really what he is. We're going to see the same thing. And he's on, as you intimated, he's on a trajectory for a one-term presidency. If he can't get the housing situation straightened out, 10 million foreclosures, if he can't get 25 million people employed again, or some of them, he's going to be a one-termer, just like Carter was. And the Republicans know that. They smell blood. They've been sticking it to him for 2 years. He's been stretching out his hand, all this bipartisan nonsense. Every time he stretches it out, they bite it. He puts it out again, they bite it. When's this guy going to get smart is the question here. I don't think he will. And I think all this bipartisan nonsense, I think the guy just wants to be liked too much. And the Republicans know that, and the conservatives know that, and they're taking advantage of that, and they're giving them the deep six. Senate Leader McConnell pretty much said so. He let it slip after the elections that their whole strategy is going to be how they get rid of him in two more years. They're not going to cooperate with him. Three strikes and you're out, usually, isn't it? 30 years, three strikes. Democrats can't even deliver on their own minimal program, and they end up Republicans. I really think it's time for another party.
Well, that was a key point in your article.
I'm talking about some other political formation left to center. Because, look, what happened in the elections? Here's a telling figure for you. In 2008, 64% turned out to vote for Obama. 64%, I believe it was, or maybe it was 54. 54 or 64. How many turned out to vote for him this time? 29. Republicans, you could say, well, midterm elections, it always declines. Well, Republicans, 52% voted, 51% voted for Republican candidates, and 42%. In other words, their normal drop in midterm election was far less. Obama lost half of his constituency. And that constituency were the youth, minority, workers, independents, everybody turned away from him. Why? Because his whole strategy, which was convinced to him by his banker friends who really run his administration, there's Larry Summers and all those guys, they're all bankers. They're not Clintonites, because the common denominator between Clinton's advisors and cabinet and Obama's is not Clintonites, it's bankers. And their whole strategy was, well, bail us out, give us $5 trillion, bail us out, and after a year or so, we'll start lending. Well, he fell for it. Okay. Well, he probably fell for it because his biggest campaign contributors were hedge funds. The guy comes out of the pocket of the big finance. They're the ones who put him over the top, and during the campaign, the election campaign. So there's no difference here, and it's not surprising. You see, the Republicans mess it up, and then the Democrats come in and take the heat and screw it up and create the condition for the Republicans to come back. That's the repeat we've seen for 40 years now.
Well, Jack, you raise a very important topic in your article, the idea of forming a new party on the left. We certainly have maybe the beginnings of something like that on the right with the Tea Party. In America, once we had a party that represented labor, but we certainly have no party representing labor now, and you say it's time to form a labor party. The history of this country, by the way, is you got to go back a good ways, aside from independent parties that got nowhere. The last one that got a pretty good chunk of votes was Ross Perot in 1992. People were mad at Bush because of SNL debacle and so on. Mm-hmm. So the vote was split, and Bill Clinton became president. But you go back to the 19th century, and parties came and parties went. They disappeared. We had the Federalists, and we had the Whigs, and, they haven't been around in over a century and a half. The Republicans were born 4 years before Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican, became president. It was a different party back then. It certainly is not the Republican Party of today. We need a new party, Jack. I absolutely agree with you.
Well, there's a couple of other interesting parallels, not just the one I gave, two others. Let me just briefly mention them. Compare Obama's program here this year and what he's done to what FDR did in 1934.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And there's interesting parallels. FDR comes into office with a very conservative program in 1933. What does he do? He doesn't initiate the New Deal. What he does is bail out the banks and institute a program, a set of programs that are designed to raise business prices, because they had deflation then. That was a big problem, right? Called the NRA, the National Recovery Act. Bailing out the banks stops the collapse of the Depression, but it doesn't generate a recovery. There's a little bit of a blurb, a recovery in 33, but it stalls out after about 9 months. And in 34, the economy is stagnant. And in the summer of 34, FDR and the Democrats kind of know that they're in trouble. But what does FDR do? He doesn't sit back and wait and hope that his pro-business strategy actually eventually works before November. What FDR does is develop, and his advisors develop, the New Deal conceptually, ideas, and they go out and they campaign on the New Deal. I'm talking about campaigning on Social Security, right, unions to right workers to have unions, the Works Progress Administration that hires quickly the equivalent of 30 million people today. All these programs excited people during the midterm election in 1934, and he got even a greater majority in 1934, and he could implement the New Deal in 35. Obama does just the opposite, just as Clinton and Carter did the opposite. This is not the Democratic Party it used to be. This is a Democratic Party that's been captured by the corporate wing called the Democratic Leadership Conference. And ever since the 1980s, they've been ruling the Democratic Party with a very pro-corporate program. And we see the results of that.
We sure do, Jack. The hour goes by much, much too fast. I look forward to getting you back for another edition of this at later in December. We'll steer clear of the Christmas holidays. Oh, the holidays do mess me up a little bit, although I'll have recorded programs over Thanksgiving weekend. PRN will have no live programming, but I'll record two programs early in the week. They'll be played over the weekend, and I've got to check my schedule late in December to be sure that I steer clear of the Christmas weekend that unfortunately falls on my program dates. Well, bah humbug, I say. Good information is more important than holidays. But, Jack, this is big, big stuff, and we need to continue this. And there's so much more to go into. We could have spent 2-3 hours talking about this, and we still can't cover everything that we should. But I always thank you for coming on. Your ideas are terrific, and your predictions are very prescient, to say the least. Maybe you'll clue me in on when the stock market will top and when it'll hit a bottom so we can announce it. No, we don't want to announce it.
Okay. Well, I always write in December my predictions for the coming year that get published in Z Magazine, so I'll be able to share those with you.
That sounds like a terrific topic for the next program. I'll shoot you an email right now, and with the holiday weekend, I'll throw the date at you to be sure there's no confusion on it. But I look forward to next time, Jack, absolutely.
As well.
And join us again tomorrow, same time. We'll have more top discussion, more vital information. That's what you get on this program. That's what you get on PRN. Make this and make PRN a regular habit.